Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Brazilian Iduna Vinhedo is the youthful face of Bodega y Cavas Vinhedo, one of the most traditional wineries in Argentina, and an acute observer of the ups and downs of her adopted country. Listen to her talk about the European Vinhedo style, about its legendary winemaker Don Raúl de la Mota, about the virtues of patience and the advantages of maturing wines in large wooden casks. Hi Iduna, how are you?
Hello, Tim. Buenos dias.
Indeed. Where are you?
I'm in Buenos Aires. I've been locked down in Buenos Aires since March. So here I am. It's still a beautiful city and going into springtime, so can't really complain that much.
Yeah, and the opposite's true here in the UK. Today was really, really wet and windy. Anyway, look, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Lots of questions and lots of subjects for discussion. I thought we'd just start with a little bit about you. That, you know, your family's from Brazil, isn't it? Not from Argentina. I just wonder what made your father Bernardo go to Argentina in 1975 to set up a winery.
Oh, well, that's actually a very interesting story because we don't really have any sort of wine connection before my dad. And my dad, well, he was born in 1932 in the south of Brazil, and he started his career within international transport. So this is back in the 50s, more or less. And especially international transport, which wasn't a big thing at that point, it wasn't regulated or anything. So he found kind of a niche in that market, especially between Brazil, Uruguay, Argentina, and Chile. Chile was always a huge exporter of wine into Brazil. And into the late 60s and early 70s, Brazil started drinking a lot more wine, especially Chilean wines and European wines. My dad is a huge fan of Bordeaux wines. And he noticed that Argentina, although there was a huge culture of wine and wine producing in Mendoza, which he knew the city because of the passage, the international passage between Chile and Argentina, he noticed that Argentina was very focused in domestic market, huge quantities of wine, and really was not focused in exports. But there was this kind of potential. So his first idea was actually to set up an import company in Brazil to import Argentine wines. Right, so he comes in the early 70s with this idea, and basically it was a no-no, right? So we don't have any surplus. Everything is drunk in the domestic market. And if we remember at that point in the 70s, Argentina was drinking 90 liters per capita. So it was this massive quantities of wine.
And even more in Buenos Aires. Buenos Aires was over 100.
Exactly. So Buenos Aires, well, actually you had the big wineries from Mendoza shipping wines by train, bulk wine by train, and it was bottled here in Buenos Aires. So it was a very different kind of conception of wine. But he thought there was a potential. Argentina had the culture, especially from the Spanish and Italian immigrants. And he loved kind of the passion of Argentina for the wine. So that is how he decided to invest and bought a dilapidated winery, a beautiful building built in 1890, which was, well, it is in over Avenida San Martin, which at that point was the international route towards Chile. So he would go back and forth and pass this beautiful, beautiful winery, which had been abandoned for more than 20 years. And this is how he decided to buy this winery in 1975, rebuild, reconvert, and start producing wines always focused in the international market, where obviously he had also a lot of contacts through transport, right? So that's how Vinhedo started in 1975.
Mm. How interesting. I mean, he made a number of very smart choices. One, as you say, was buying that incredible winery, which is one of the most beautiful wineries in Argentina. The other was appointing Don Raúl de la Mota as his first winemaker. And, you know, he's one of the legends of the industry, really. How important was Don Raúl in deciding on the style of the Vinet Wines. And did you get to know him well?
Yes. Well, I was lucky to know him quite well because, well, at that point, the family was all in Brazil. I was born in Brazil. Later on, I was born in 1981. So we would come every 6 months, we would come to Argentina. And until nowadays, my school friends think I'm half Argentine because it was always he's in Argentina, right? So everyone thinks that my dad is Argentine, but no, we're actually Brazilians. And how he got to know Don Raul, my father was a very good friend of the Flichmann family. And so he bought this winery in 1975. And basically, he went golfing with Flichmann and said, listen, I bought this winery. I'm not a winemaker. I'm a wine drinker. What do I do now? So Flichmann was the one to say, speak to this guy, Don Raul. I think he is one of the best winemakers in Mendoza, and he will be able to help you, basically. At that point, Don Raul was working at Arisu, the original, the very big Arisu winery, also just basically producing massive quantities of wine. But Don Raul was already thinking of the potential of Argentina producing high-quality wines. He was kind of a pen pal to Emile Peynot. So he had all of these concepts of vinifying by varietal, of having a vineyard and a 100% varietal vineyard as well, kind of just focusing into a higher quality wine from the vineyard up to vinification and everything. So when my father came with the project of producing high quality wines and wines that would be able to compete in the export market, Don Raul basically said, okay, this is what we need to do. We need to do 100% varietals. We need to focus on the vineyards. We need to go into older vines as well. And so I really do think that Vinyard in terms of style was pretty much Don Raul as a winemaker. And I think a perfect pair with my dad as an entrepreneur, basically, you know, giving him the tools to produce these wines, right? So during 2 years, the reconversion of the winery was built to basically produce also bulk wines, like 3 million liters of huge tanks. And they reconverted during 2 years into smaller tanks of 5,000 liters, 10,000 liters, up to 80,000 liters, which are the bigger tanks that we have nowadays. But focus into single vineyard winemaking when single vineyard wasn't even a thing, a marketing thing. It was basically to have a very clear view of each one of the vines that we work with, you know, each one of the wines, a profile of the wines, and the aging process, the mature vintages, just having kind of a complete wine put into the market, right? So all that fruit expression, which has always been, you know, the bigger quality of wines from Mendoza, but also that kind of the European inheritance, I guess, Mendoza, right? The kind of the Italian and Spanish roots of having mature vintages and long aging process. And well, we have a beautiful cask collection nowadays, which was built over the past 45 years, which allow us to continue to do that, to continue to kind of pursue what Don Raul's first vision was back in the 70s. Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, the style is being variously described as, you know, European, classical, traditional. I suppose it's a bit of all of those three, really. But I think it's amazing that, you know, your first wine was 1977 and it was the equivalent of a home run, really, you know, in a baseball game that you know, it was one of the greatest wines ever made in Argentina. Was there beginner's luck in that, or, you know, what made that wine so special? I know you've tasted it a few times, lucky you. I haven't.
I do. Well, if I'm a good girl, every Christmas we have a bottle. My dad's splash.
Oh, thanks for sharing.
Well, you're invited for the next Christmas, don't worry.
Thank you.
But it was a little bit of beginner's luck. It was a little bit as well of kind of almost I don't know, a testing, because especially the Malbec Estrella 1977, it was harvested, it was picked by the first week of April in 77. And at that point, the wines, the grapes were always picked earlier. They were picked by mid-February up to the first week of March, especially before the very big hailstorm seasons, right? So basically by the beginning of March and into mid-March, it is very common to have hailstorms in Mendoza. And if you think of our other wines, they all have 13.5, 13.8% alcohol. The Malbec Estrella has 14.5. So that extra maturation, which was really kind of an experiment, right? So let's see how long and how this wine can come through with this extra maturation, extra ripening of the grape. And that, at least this is what I remember of Don Raul back in the mid-80s and 90s. He was very strict. But once a year, we were able to do a tasting through the casks and all the cellars with Don Raul. It was kind of a very, very interesting experience for, us young kids to be with this eminent and, older guy and very, very strict. And he was always telling us the stories of the 77 vintage. And this is one story that I've always remembered, that everyone thought they were crazy. You know, other winemakers were like, you're completely crazy. It's April and you're still picking grapes. What are you doing? And especially being Brazilians, like, oh, those Brazilian people, the Brazilians, always the bigger one in the world. That rivalry. And it ended up being these five casks of the Malbec 77, which had such an interesting structure and were so much more expressive than the other ones. Because we did a normal Malbec 77, which has 13.6% alcohol. So these wines, these five casks, they aged for 19 years, which was also kind of experimental. Let's see what happens with a Malbec, which is aged for more than 3, 4, 5, or 10 years. So 19 years later, so this is 1996, Vineyard was already, quite a big brand around the world, exporting to many markets, quite big in the domestic market. And my father basically brought a sample to Buenos Aires to, the press, the local press. And they didn't have a brand for this 1977 special lot. And one journalist said, Bernardo, this is the star of Vineyard. This is the best wines that I've ever tasted from you guys. And this is how the Malbec Estrella 1977 was born. So it is kind of a little bit of everything, but also kind of this experimental, work, I guess, just to see what happens. Yeah. Let's see what happens.
Well, it worked out. Yeah. I mean, you've mentioned the big old oak cask. You have these so-called toneles, as they're called in Spanish, and they're kind of at the heart of the style in many ways. How many of them have you got, and what size are they? How old are they? I mean, they really, the place smells of those casks, doesn't it, when you walk into the cellar? It's very atmospheric.
It is. Yeah, it is quite magical. I think the cellars at Vineyard, they kind of speak by themselves. We have today 260 of these toneles or casks. So we have up to 1.1 million liters aging at once. We usually have between 13 and 16 different vintages. And they vary in size between 1,800 liters. There's one little cask of 1,800 liters. One very big cask of 44,000 liters. It's also the older casks that we have. This particular cask, this massive cask, was brought to Argentina by the beginning of the 1900s, I think 1910, and it was assembled in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it's still, we have a Malbec 2012, nowadays aging in this cask, which is beautiful, but most of them are between 2,000 liters, which are kind of the oval ones, and 6,000 liters, the rounder ones, right? And they're very, very different. In terms of their of what they induce to the wines, the oval ones, they're usually a little bit more oaky within the wines. Although they're 50, 60, 70 years old, there's still kind of this wood induction. The bigger ones, the 6,000 liters one, keep, concentrate, and kind of guard the fruit expression very well. And then it also depends on where the wine is located within the cellar and the air current. So it's kind of this huge palette of wines that, we have available to blend in after, our long aging processes. So it's quite interesting. Many variables, I guess, for blending.
Yeah. Blending is one of the key things, isn't it? You've mentioned Hubert, or we haven't yet, but we're mentioning him now, who's your second winemaker. That you've only had two winemakers. He's a Swiss winemaker. And you've described him as a master blender. I mean, he's a very good winemaker, but blending is a really important part of what he does, isn't it, from what you've said?
Absolutely. So Hubert came to Argentina in 1996. And the reason why he came from Switzerland as a very young winemaker, he was 25 at the time, he had tasted the Cavas de Vineyard, which is our cask selection we're going to taste today. And he tasted the 1985 vintage and thought it was very different and very beautiful compared to what he was tasting from Argentina. And that point, Hubert had already been in Austria working with Acacia casks. He had been in within the north of Italy as well, basically doing practices. But he was kind of specializing, or had the thought of specializing himself in a winemaker with casks and bigger barrels. So that was kind of his vision as a very young professional. So when he came to Argentina, he actually came for just 1 year, practice.
He was inspired to come by a vine at wine, was he?
He was, yeah. So basically in 1992, he tasted the wine. He asked our Swiss importer to contact Weinert and asked to come to Argentina for a one-year practice with Don Raul. So this was in 1996. And at that point, Don Raul was already into his early 80s or late 70s. So we were, you know, looking for another winemaker, a second winemaker who would continue the work of Don Raul. But obviously at that point as well, you know, most winemakers in Argentina were more into a modern contemporary school. So we were basically kind of, well, let's see what happens. So when Hubert came in 96, he did a 1 year practice with Don Raul. And after that, I remember this meeting between Don Raul and my dad in the, you know, December of 1996 saying, you know, this young guy, he has the nose, because blending is very important in our wines. And he's got, you know, kind of the potential to carry on with, you know, Don Raul's project at Weinert. So in 1997, he stepped up as first winemaker. And I do think that Hubert's biggest quality is kind of the blending, the master blending. He gets very excited. It's really interesting to see him within the, you know, the blending process of each one of the wines. He almost like a little kid, you know, with his special product. And his family comes from, you know, restaurateurs. His grandfather was a chef in a Swiss hotel. So he always tells us the story of, you know, him coming back from school and trying to guess what was being cooked, or what were the elements that were in each one of the, you know, the lunches and dinners every single day, like garlic and all of the little, you know, herbs and stuff. So, and he's got a blending music for each one of the wines. So it's really kind of a very holistic inspiration. He puts together usually 4 to 5 tests. Right. So blends, different blends, like with subtle differences. And then we have basically a big tasting team where I also make sure that, you know, people, for example, production department taste the wines. They're not involved in necessarily the fermenting and vinification, but they're still, you know, very, very, very aware of what, you know, the Weinert style is.
They're all involved.
They're all involved. They end up being very involved. We have a very young administrative today. She's 27, 28, which I always tell, you know, Belen, I want you to taste, because you're a virgin palate, right? You're not used to some things that we might get used to, because, you know, we need to have kind of that sort of feedback as well from the outside world. And also whenever we have either buyers or even friends coming along, if it's blending season, you know, they taste through a couple of blends. So it's kind of a very, it's an interesting, you know, together with Harvest, it's kind of the second biggest movement in the winery, which is July and August. So we have just
Team dynamic. Well, listen, I read something that you said that time is one of our biggest allies and assets, which I think is a rather lovely thing to say. Do you think that winemakers need patience to appreciate your wines?
I think so, definitely. I mean, I think our biggest investment is definitely time. You know, from our younger wines in the market today is the 2017 vintages. And then we have our current releases of 2009, you know, a couple of special bottlings, 2008 or even 1994, which is one of our single casks, which we released 23 years later in 2017. So we do invest a lot of time in producing our wines. Obviously, as a second generation of the family and having the opportunity to have, you know, 260 casks in our collection, I'm very grateful that my dad started that in 1975. But I think time and that patience that we invest and we focus in the wines, it is very, very important. I think that's one of our biggest differences within, you know, the rest of the industry. And it's not that it's better or worse. It's just the style, right? And I think that the great thing about the wine business is kind of there are so many different personalities, different stories, and different styles of wines that you cannot get bored drinking wine. You know, there's always something else and something next and something else to discover. So I definitely think, and I'm, as you know, with our new administration and everyone who comes into the winery, we always make sure that they understand that time is important for us and that we want to give them time, right? So
yeah,
it's, you know, the accountancy, obviously, no, we're not gonna
they're less happy.
I'm going to rush it through, just forget about it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, your wines are sometimes compared to Chateau Musard in the Lebanon and maybe Lopez de Heredia, you know, Viña Tondonia in Aro in the Rioja. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think so. I actually got my wine bug off Chateau Musard. And this is back in the year 2000. So I was 19 at the time. And I didn't want to work with my father or the family business. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm going to do my own thing and, you know, do whatever. I wanted to be independent, basically. But basically, my dad said, you know, I need to go to New York. I need a translator. I need to attend this wine fair. I didn't know I was illegal at that point.
Only just.
So there I go. And this was back when California with the very, very big Oaky Cabernets was right, you know, kind of on their cusp. So I'm tending the tables, you know, blah, blah, blah with Vineyard. And then my dad says, why don't you go around and taste some wines? Mm-hmm. I said, okay, great. So I'm tasting all of these very big, bold cabs. I'm like, oh, no. I mean, my palate was just rejecting everything. At that point, I'm like, I'm definitely not fit for this business. You know, all of these great wines, fantastic, super point. You know, I don't like any of them. I don't understand this business until I get to a table with a little plate said, Lebanon. I'm like, didn't know Lebanon made wine. And on the table was Serge Rochat. I didn't know who he was. So basically, we start talking like, I'm from Argentina, Lebanon. And he gave me a couple of his wines. And finally, it was like my comfort zone. I was like, oh, finally, love these wines. Fantastic. Like, yes, this is wine for me. And he pulls a bottle under the table. It was the 1979. I had no idea, you know, blind taste me. Like, let me know what vintage you think this is. And it reminded me of our 77, the Malbec. So I said, I don't know, late 70s. And he said, why do you say that? Well, because we have a Malbec 77, which has kind of this port-like, very dry cherry, you know, style and a little funk. And it was a 1979. So after that, I'm like, okay, maybe I'm ready to go. And so that's how I actually
got
back to Buenos Aires. I'm like, well, you know, maybe I could do something. Do you need somebody to, you know, I don't know, just do anything? And then I went from everyone's assistant, from the accountancy, sales. I went into the sales team in Buenos Aires. I went into a tourism guide in Mendoza. So I kind of did a little bit of everything in the winery until I finally settled myself in the sales part, which is where I'm also most comfortable with. So, yeah, so that's kind of my story.
We haven't really talked about the vineyards. I think how much do you own? 40 hectares now?
We have 40 hectares.
And you also buy grapes, don't you?
Exactly. And we buy a lot of grapes. We actually have always bought a lot of grapes because back in 75, my father bought the winery but wasn't able to buy the vineyards, which was where we are, was basically vineyard region. Today it's an urban, very posh urban area. He wasn't able to buy, you know, the vineyards which were around the winery. So we have always bought a lot of grapes. We have today up to 20 producers. Some of them have 1 hectare, and some of them, the bigger one has 30 hectares in the south of Luján de Cuyo and Ugarteche. But basically, these are, you know, family vineyards, and grape growing is a very important economic activity in Mendoza. You know, it is very common for wineries to have their own vineyards and to buy grapes as well. And it's interesting because it's such a very wide region. Even Luján de Cuyo Maipú, where we're focused at, which is kind of the first zone of Mendoza, the Primera Zona, as we call it, you have a very, very different soils. It's very heterogeneous. From within even the same vineyard, you have very different soil types. So you get also a very nice diversity of grapes and wines working with different grape growers, right? And especially with our wines, where we look for wines or grapes which can produce wines which are going to go into a very long aging process. They need structure. They need kind of the phenolic structure to go through this very long aging process. So these old vines up to 120 years old, Malbecs that we get, are basically from families which are maybe in their third or fourth generation of this particular economic activity, which is, you know, selling grapes to other wineries.
Do you have any grapes from the Uco Valley or not? Or is it all Luján de Cuyo and Maipú?
We have ventured for the first time in the Uco Valley in this vintage with a Pinot Noir from Gualtajarí. It's a rosé, so we have just launched it in the domestic market 2 weeks ago. And although I'm a huge fan of the Uco Valley, one of my favorite wines is, you know, from Gerardo Michelini. I really like his style of wines as well. And we have kind of experimented. We do have a couple of wines from Tupungato, Merlots especially, which go into the Carrascal and the Cavas. But basically, our style is very proper of Luján de Cuyo. I think that Uco Valley, we're always looking into, you know, different things and tasting different wines and looking into different grape growers as well. But especially for the very classical and traditional line that we have, the Carrascal, Vinert, and Cavas, we feel that Luján de Cuyo and Maipú with the older vines and the genetic pool that you get as well, are, you know, the wines that have that structure to produce not only the style that we have, but especially, you know, which can go through this very long and very aerobic vinification process, right? Whenever people say, oh, why don't you go? I'm like, well, you know, the personality of a winery is very important, I think. You know, this is something I've always defended. And especially trends, you know, they come and go, and there's always something new and always, you know, a new region. And I think being classical more than a style is also a philosophy where, you know, you keep faithful to yourself, and then you can speak through generations because people know what they're going to get when they buy a bottle of Vinert. And then, you know, and that's kind of where our standpoint is.
Yeah, I mean, you're what, 99% red wine, but you also make a little bit of white, don't you? Tell us a bit about the white. What's the white?
The white is a Chardonnay from Ugarteche and El Carrizal, which are the south regions of Luján de Cuyo. Half of it is in Parral, right? So the pergola system, very salty, very carbonated soil. And the other half is in Espaldera. How do you say Espaldero in English?
On trellis.
There you go. On
trellis. And
the particularity of this varietal Chardonnay is that it's fermented with acacia staves, right? So that's kind of Hubert's experience in Austria. Still, you know, there's always something European in our wines. Even with the white, it's, you know, kind of that acacia instead of the, you know, the French oak, we fermented with acacia staves just to add a little bit of that kind of the floral notes. It's really beautiful because you get kind of the tiny white flowers, elegance into the wine and just makes it kind of a little bit, you know, higher acidity as well, especially with the pergola system protecting the grapes from the sun exposure. So, you know, kind of that, it's always with a little foot on, you know, on Europe. So that's white today. Yeah.
I mean, I've got to ask you about Argentinian politics and the economy. You're always a very interesting person to talk to about both. Just wonder, you know, what's the view from Buenos Aires like at the moment? What sort of shape is the economy and the country in right now?
I think it's going through a political schizophrenia. We've been under a complete lockdown since March. And I think Argentina, and this is me speaking as a Brazilian and from kind of an outside, although I know Argentina for a very long time, you know, kind of an outside view, is that Argentina, since the Peronism began in the 50s and 60s, it's always been kind of this vicious swirl where nobody really knows how to get out of it. It's a very rich country, right? Very, very rich country. Still very tied to the rural agriculture. So especially the primary, material, soybeans, there's always the discussion of the retentions, the export on taxes. And especially with this government, I think that they have also taken the pandemic as the perfect excuse for a very, very harsh economic recession. Argentina today, it's a kind of a mess, which is probably something that you've heard before, and many people feel that way. There is an imminent opposition, kind of an imminent, strong but real opposition coming through in the government, which is interesting, because if not, really, Argentina doesn't have kind of a plan for the country. And one thing that I've always thought of Argentina is that it's very presidentialistic. What do I mean by that? Depending on the president, it goes either to the hard left or the hard right, or forward or backwards, and there isn't a plan for the country itself. And it's a rich country, with a small population, still very well educated. So the potential for Argentina is huge. But politically, it's been caught in kind of this, this mess where, instead of looking forward and thinking of how to build the country again and how to use all this potential, and not only, natural resources, but the potential of the society as well, Argentines are perfect crisis managers, because everyone's very used to being very creative, because we're always in a crisis, right? It is kind of a way of life. And also, one thing that I've always loved about Argentina is that you have so many small businesses. People are willing to invest, and they need to invest. So you have from a kiosco, but it's dealt as a real business, or just basically you have like many different little businesses, which is not the case, for example, in Brazil. Brazil is either multinational or public administration, right? And the laws for the, what we call in Argentina, the PYME is pequeña y mediana empresa. So basically the small and medium-sized companies, and their laws specifically to, protect and, try to, incentive these type of companies. In Brazil, these laws were passed only 15 years ago. Which is crazy.
Argentina
since ever, in the 60s or 70s. But.
Final question. How do you get away from wine? I mean, I know you're a big reader. Is that your main interest when you're not tasting wine, selling wine, traveling the world?
It is one of my main interests. I do like to read a lot. And I try to read as well in... I'm a bigger reader in English and Spanish than I am in Portuguese. Although Portuguese is my mother language. I'm also a big fan of swimming, although I found out that you're not allowed to swim in the Mendoza Dam, the Potrerillos, very recently, because I was basically, this is not allowed to swim. Like, why? It's water. Don't worry. I was an open water swimmer in Brazil. But yeah, you're not, it's difficult to go swimming in the desert, I guess.
So what are you reading at the moment? Anything you'd recommend?
I have actually two books. One is Aramburu, which is a very political novel based on true facts, the assassination of a general by the Montoneros in the 70s, right? So Argentine history. And I'm also reading, what's it called in English? Atlas Shrugged, La Rebelión de Atlas from Ayn Rand. Which is kind of a very, very interesting novel on the right liberal economic views, right? So, I guess those are very, very political. I guess I'm spending a little bit more of your garden time.
Very different books. Anyway, look, Iduna, it's been a pleasure talking to you as ever. Fantastic to chat to you, and big fan of your wines. And I think that wonderful traditional European style really brings something very special to Argentina. So thanks to you and to your family.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you. And I hope to see you soon personally.
And you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I really must get to try some of that 1977 Estrella Malbec next time I'm in Argentina. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is Jacques Lurton, one of the original flying winemakers and now the man in charge of André Lurton Vineyards in Bordeaux. See you then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @TimAtkin, and on Instagram, @TimAtkinMW. See you next week.